This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Now let's go back to the case that everybody's loving talking about and can't wait for it to end. The prosecution has rested its case in the Lindsey Clancy trial. Defense will be resting soon as well. After 14 days at Plymouth Superior Court, and some of what happened inside that courtroom has legal analysts asking whether the Plymouth County DA's office is reading the room very well. Eric Faddis is a defense attorney and former prosecutor who can help us read what's been happening.
One of the best. There.
And we'd love for your thoughts in the comments section. Let's start here. Lindsey Clancy's former mother-in-law, Susan Clancy, told the jury Lindsey was very nurturing, a very loving mother, a wonderful mother on cross. I mean, again, this is mother-in-law. So seen in many cases where the mother does horrible things to the grandchildren, mom-in-law is usually one of the most vitriolic, bitch-should-die people in the case. This ain't that at all. Very nurturing, very loving, wonderful mother, her words. On cross, the prosecutor asked Susan if she was an active member of the Catholic Church. Said yes. And then, so you're aware that murder is considered a mortal sin. The judge struck it from the record pretty damn quick. Eric, help us understand. Was that calculated? Was that someone overstepping their bounds? Well, what do you think was going on in the minds of the ADA at that moment in time?
You know, in part, the prosecution has to prove that Lindsey Clancy knew right from wrong, among a lot of other elements they have to prove.
Yeah.
And I think this question was sort of calculated to maybe touch on that, but it doesn't make sense because it's Lindsey Clancy's mental state that is material. It's not the mother-in-law, whether the mother-in-law thinks it's some kind of mortal sin. And in fact, when you inject the religious judgment piece to this, I think it's prosecutorial misconduct. I think you're running the risk of trying to, you know, scare these jurors, perhaps some jurors who might be religiously oriented,
yeah,
and say, oh, you know, this is a mortal sin, you better punish her for that. I think it is totally improper. The judge made the right call.
What really, there's so many striking things this case, and you know, as this recording I was just watching before we started, Dr. Resnick's testimony, who is the expert on postpartum psychosis, if in the country, if not the world, really doing an amazing job explaining what the and really dismantling what the prosecution's accusing. We'll see what happens when the jury gets it. What I'm really curious about this, Eric, because this is a very unique case on so many fronts, but one of the behavior sides that I have found very unique, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on how that hits home to, since we're talking about the prosecutors, the two in there. When you have an entire room, now I'm not the entire room because I know they have their own witnesses coming in there, but when the courtroom is filled with family, friends, colleagues, people who lived and experienced Lindsey throughout their life, going back 15, 20, and her 30 plus years of life, all standing with her on the defense side, and you're the two prosecutors in there, and you come across in these moments being very tone deaf. How does that resonating with them? What do you think they're feeling? How do you think they're able to, is it affecting them as prosecutors, you think? I mean, it's a very unique situation that, because I was even thinking about this, you know, when it comes to if she's convicted, if they find her guilty and they give victim impact statements, who? I mean, because right. they're all standing, yeah, with Lindsey. So, I mean, it's a very unique situation. How does that resonate as a prosecutor to them, do you think?
I think as a prosecutor, you're like, whoa, I'm outnumbered. And I think you're also like, whoa, I thought going in this case was pretty strong and people would agree with me that Lindsey was in the wrong. But gosh, look at these rows and rows of human beings who have known Lindsey her entire life, who are sticking by her. And not only the effect on the prosecutor, Robin, the effect on the jury. The jury is watching who is in that courtroom, where they're sitting, whom they're sitting behind, whom they seem to be supporting. And that could go a long way. That even though it's not technically evidence the jury's allowed to consider, you better believe they're going to say, hey, they've got dozens of people here behind this person. If she was such a monster that the prosecution was making her out to be, these folks wouldn't be here.
I got another question for the courtroom conduct and how and what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do in these situations, and what you think the the jury is picking up on. So I've done my best. I've watched most of it live, and if not, I saw it on playback. And because it is literally one of the most fascinating things I've ever watched in my life, because it's like watching a Netflix special, because it's so it sucks you in, because it's so important. The stakes are so high, and the content is so impactful on our society, really, because we're talking about women's mental health. And when her fellow colleague, one of the nurses that she worked with in labor delivery, she'd known, I think, Lindsay, and I apologize to everyone that listens in. I'm always off a little bit on my stats, and so I might be off, but about 15 years she knew her. And I watched her when she come off the witness stand after she's interviewed by Reddington, the prosecutors, and then a little bit of redirect. And so as she's coming off, she made a slight little head nod to Lindsay, I caught it. And I was like, wow, even after all this, this woman is still letting her know, because she even said, I'm still friends with her today. And she gave her that little glance. So my question is she allowed to do that? And either way, do you think that's something that resonates well with the jury or not?
Typically, you are not supposed to engage in gestures or facial expressions or something like that that is not evidence, but that the jury might see that could influence them. And so a lot of times you see like attorneys or defendants or the prosecutors asking a question, they're rolling their eyes. They say, oh my God, how could they even be suggesting this? And the judge will say, hey, you cannot be making those facial expressions, those gestures. They might affect the jury in an improper way. So it's probably improper, but those things happen all the time. And you better believe some of the jurors picked up on that.
It was a micro. I mean, I'm talking, you know, micro expressions happen in like an eighth or a 16th of a second. And it was a micro, but I saw it and I was like, huh, wow, she's still connected. Anyway, thanks.
I want to go back to the mortal sin. because
that was something, wasn't it?
It is. I mean, and being as improper as it might have been, I agree with Eric. I don't know that it was necessarily for the mother. You know, I mean, she had to direct it at somebody. So she directed it towards the mother. But in doing so, it is throwing it into the ether of, to anyone who I guess would be religious, would be, is that a mortal sin? Oh my! And you're going to have to question that yourself, whether the question is directed at you or not. So every single juror sitting there is going to be facing that question, you know, depending on their belief system. Mm-hmm. And I know Reddington, you know, said disregard. And there's moments in trials all the time where it's disregard this, disregard that. But sometimes those disregards end up becoming appellate issues. If she is convicted on this, let's say she is convicted on this. How big of a nugget is that if they needed to go and appeal this to a higher court, the fact that she brought that level of religious vitriol into this? Have you ever seen that before in other cases where religiosity gets injected in some way, shape, or form, and it's used as a lever on appeals?
Oh, sure. You know, those things can pop up. And sometimes it varies by jurisdiction. Sometimes, if you have a more rural, perhaps yeah. conservative, perhaps traditional type of jurisdiction, you might see more references to God and references to religion than you mm-hmm. would, you know, in a downtown Denver case or something.
Yeah.
So, but yes, I think that it is very ripe for an appellate ground if there is a conviction, because yeah. you, Tony, you cannot play upon the jury's sympathies or prejudices in order to try to convict a person. And when you are going to perhaps the heart of their identity, they might be a very religious person,
yeah.
and they might now be thinking, hey, can I really let a person go on a mortal sin? Can I live with that in my conscience? No, I better convict them. Well, you've got appellate issues galore.
Is religion one of the questions on the questionnaire, you think, for the jury questionnaire?
It can be. There's been a push away from that. So you usually now you don't ask like political affiliation, religious affiliation. But if there's something that's relevant to the case in terms of religiousness, that can be inquired into. So, yeah, those things they're less expressly referenced in jury selection now, but you can still you can still acquire that.
And which begs my thought and question, like we've been saying, was that question necessarily geared for the mother-in-law of Lindsay, or was it really geared for impact on the jury? And if it was geared for the impact on the jury, knowing, I mean, hell, I just listened to you and Bob Mata, you know, talk about this stuff, and I'm saying that was like a dumb move because of the appellate process. And he raised the objection, which means they can bring it up. Do you think that was a good strategic move? Because these prosecutors, I looked them up. I think one of them has like 15 years, you know, sitting as a prosecutor for the state. I think, again, don't quote me, everyone. I don't have my notes right in front of me, but she's got some experience. Is that a rookie move, or do you think it was strategic?
I think it was a move of desperation. I think a lot of people have feelings about the direction this trial's going, and the prosecutor's included in that, and I think it was a desperate move. Hmm.
Good point.
Back to mortal sin.
Sorry, I shouldn't be laughing.
Let's say she gets convicted here, and then let's say they're doing an interview on Dateline or somebody's show. And why did you convict her? Well, because it was a mortal sin. And that's their answer. And I know we weren't supposed to take that into consideration, and I didn't. But I myself reflected on that and realized that is a mortal sin, and I have to convict based on that being a mortal sin. Is that Becky Hill all over again to a certain extent? I mean, it's a different type of dynamic, and who's saying it? But does that... I mean, once a verdict is rendered, and if a juror were then to tell, here's how I came to my conclusion, and they came to that conclusion through a path that the judge flat out said, disregard, but they went there anyway, and they're saying, well, it didn't have anything to do with them saying it, but it's my own convictions, regardless if it was said out loud or not. Where does that go?
What you're touching on is something appellate courts are always looking at when they're deciding whether to overturn a conviction, and that's the effect on the juror. There can be a lot of problematic stuff that goes on in a trial. No one is entitled constitutionally to a perfect trial. You're just entitled to a trial devoid of constitutional errors. And so, and even if some of those errors happen, the impact, if they didn't impact the overall determination, oftentimes that's not going to result in reversal. And so if there is impact on some juror because of that statement, I think that you are looking at a get out of jail free card. You are looking at an automatic new trial.
Yeah. And think about this. It doesn't even have to be that one person that said it. I mean, so how granular does it need to be, and how subjective can it be? So say you're one of the people on the jury, and you know, because of you're sitting in the jury room together, you're conversing a lot throughout this, getting to know each other very well throughout this process, and you hear that one of your fellow jurors is a really hardcore devout Catholic, and at some point you overheard them talking about sins and everything. Could they then, through supposition or interpretation of what that actually means, say that they think they're probably swayed, and then present that, in other words, hearsay and conjecture presented out from someone else of what they think they might have done? Is that enough or no?
It very well may be. Look, at the appellate level, you do not have to prove it's 100% that this improper statement was the primary reason a juror did what they did. Your burden is lower than that. Depends on the jurisdiction, but you kind of just have to establish, you know, significant likelihood that there was such an effect. And you would use things like that, Robin. You would say, hey, these jurors heard them talking about sins and stuff. Well, a sin, that's not a basis to render a conviction. And if there is a compelling presentation that it did influence that determination, then you don't necessarily need the juror to say that expressly.
Yeah, because I can imagine they're not privy to everything that's going on in social media right now and how divided the world is on this case right now. Maybe not. I've got my fingers crossed after Dr. Resnick's presentation today. If you have critical thinkers that are still remaining on either side, it was helping that out. But because it's so divisive, I can only imagine that potentially the jury is that divisive as well on this. This is why a lot of us are thinking, you know, the probability of a hung jury is pretty high on this one, because getting a unanimous thought together on this because of the issue involved, because of the murder of the children, and also because of the mental health issue, it's very compelling on both sides. It's hard in a world to imagine it not happening, where you have one of the jurors that wanted to acquit because of insanity. I know it's not the exact, you know, thing, wordage in Massachusetts, but then coming out saying, I can overturn this because I heard this. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think cases are so commonly overturned based on what is labeled juror misconduct, but sometimes right. it's the jurors doing something they're not supposed to do because of somebody else's misconduct. And so that is a prime ground for reversing convictions, almost always looked at by every appellate counsel that I know.
She really screwed herself, that prosecutor, didn't she?
There's a lot here where you look at where was she? We've talked about this the other week. Like, were you really trying to win this, or you know, was this the kind of cards you were dealt and you put a bow in your hair and went to work and did the best you could? I mean, the prosecution opened this trial by telling the jury Lindsay was controlling, meticulous, and manipulative. And then proceeded to parade a bunch of people in front of the jury that said she was loving, she was detailed, and she was kind. And it's like, well, we don't really have any evidence of this controlling, meticulous, manipulative person here, other than the moment that she seemed to have snapped and went into this psychosis and wasn't herself at all anymore. She's paralyzed from the waist down. She cut her wrists and neck before jumping out a window. And they said that, well, you know, these are superficial. She can't walk anymore. She has no movement from her neck down in so many ways. I mean, it's like the prosecution set the bar up here, knowing full well they're going to drive into an arena where the bar is going to be way down here and everybody's going to see it's down here. That makes me not want to trust anything they're saying when, well, this is what this is, everybody, and here's what it actually is. Even if it's not, you know, it's still icky. It's still, you know, she killed her kids, but it's not what you said it was. So I don't know that I fully trust that prosecutor. I mean, how does that land in a jury when they set the bar so damn high with accusations that just are not going to be proven because they're just not accurate about someone's personality? How does a jury take that at the end of the day?
You know, the jury trial process at its best is a truth-finding process. And you can, before the trial, as a prosecutor, have a great case on paper. You think it's a great case. And then you're getting really into it. And you're like, oh, she was manipulative here. She was controlling. And I can tell the jury all these things. They're gonna side with me. But if you overplay your hand, for example, if you bring too many charges, if you're really like piling on in a way that seems unfair and unjust, the jury's going to pick up on that. Likewise, if you're trying to sell them some BS from the outset, and then they hear from witnesses and see evidence that contradicts the narrative the prosecutor is trying to sell these folks, they're going to be insulted. They're going to be offended. They're going to say, hey, you're insulting my intelligence, and you're trying to pull the wool over my eyes. I thought you guys were the good guys, prosecutors. And then it could just soil everything in the remainder of the trial.
I'm going to use Tony's words. Going back to the mortal sin.
Yeah.
So here she is. Let's assume the prosecutor's got a decent level of self-awareness. She's smart. She's educated. She reflects and she goes, uh-oh, I really hosed myself, and I hosed myself with the jury. She's got reps in front of juries like this before. What can she do, if anything, to negate that negative confirmation bias she just gave the jury about her?
What would bow. Bigger bow. Yes. Bigger bow the next day. That's how you do that.
You know, I think part of one big piece that I play upon in jury trials is vulnerability. And when there are issues or mistakes, I think it's on the balance best to own them and to say, you know, hey, we're hearing some of these people testify for the first time too, just like you are. And you know, what we need to base your determination on is what happened during this trial, not what we thought might happen or what somebody else thought might happen. But here is the reality of it. Here are the facts. And so I think trying to be a bit vulnerable in those circumstances can really go a long way with a jury.
At what point can she do that? Because, you know, it's always, you know, when you're looking at the prosecutor up there, they were just the facts, ma'am. You know, here's our witness. Here's my questions. Here's the line. She doesn't give a whole lot of narrative beforehand. So how can you insert that vulnerability throughout the course, or do you have to wait till closing arguments to do it?
You might have to wait till closing arguments, and that's a point where you can look these jurors in the eyes, and you know, prosecutors are not unfamiliar with a witness going sideways, with a witness saying something that we didn't think they would say. You got to adapt to that. You got to be ready for that. And part of that is not overplaying your hand, because you don't know exactly what it's going to look like during that gauntlet of a jury trial.
Do you think it's best for her to ignore it in closing arguments, or should she address it?
I think it makes sense to address it in sort of a glancing, sensitive sort of fashion.
Nice. Thanks. I know I've been hammering you on it. Thanks.
One more on this segment before we move out of the kind of the critique of the prosecution of Lindsay. Let me ask you this. Obviously, there's a lot of seeming from the prosecution, throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks here. I don't feel like there's been a real clear, here's why I should believe that she had a clear mind and it was just another Tuesday to Lindsay Clancy when she decides to put exercise bands around her kids, slit her wrists and her neck, and jump out a second story window. Doesn't seem like somebody is operating in their right mind. That all being said, there's a gazillion theories online. There's a gazillion rage directions that people are taking this, some based on facts, some based on misinterpretations of facts, some based on utter delusion. The jury obviously not supposed to be looking at social media, not supposed to be going online. Be honest with me. How often do jurors actually, because it's the honor system, Eric, unless they're sequestered, it's the honor system. Nobody has a check on their devices to go, oh, I see you were on Facebook last. It's just the honor system that we're operating with here. How honorable are jurors typically that they're not consuming other perspectives on cases? Quite just your gut.
My apprehension is that we have these instructions to jurors that say you can't do this, you can't do that. And there is actually a legal presumption that the jurors followed them absent some contradicting evidence. So we presume that they're going to follow them. But is that presumption really sound? Is that really reliable? You know, you think that person's not going home to their partner of 30 years? And the partner says, what's going on? And they're like, well, I'm a juror in a trial. Well, what's it about? I think some of them are going to say, hey, I can't talk about it. But you better believe, just statistically, a minority of them are going to talk about it. And they might even come into contact with coverage about it, perhaps innocently, perhaps unintentionally. And that still can be a problem.
One more question, Eric, is again, I was watching, and Gen Z, yeah, we've been going back and forth, and yeah, for everyone to get a chance today, watch Dr. Resnick's testimony today. It was really, really compelling, explained an awful lot science-wise, psychosis-wise. But a few things, and so this is my question to you, Eric. So a few times throughout his testimony, he made reference to what the jury's already heard from these other experts and a few of things like that. What are people that are testifying allowed to watch or see prior to them testifying? So in other words, I was very curious, did he just say something off that he shouldn't have seen, like he shouldn't have seen something in the case? Or, I mean, how's that work?
Yeah, really good question. So the general rule, Robin, is for a witness, there are what's called a sequestration order. It's similar to the concept of sequestering a jury, whereby that witness cannot be privy to or receive any information about what has happened in the trial before. So they can't hear the testimony of witness one if they're witness two. The exception to that, however, is experts. Experts can receive information about the case, including about what other witnesses have testified to, because those experts can opine on, you know, hey, this witness said that this happened, but in my expert opinion, that's impossible. Or this other expert said that X was the condition, but in my opinion, I think this other expert's wrong for these reasons. So an expert can opine and receive information about what else has gone on in the trial, whereas normal witnesses typically cannot.
Thanks. That's a big help, because I remember as I watched the testimony where they're interviewing and doing cross on the TikToker, and she was dismissed. And when she was even told when Reddington contacted her, he sequestered her, so she had to stop watching everything. And then all of a sudden, I saw Dr. Resnick up there saying things like he saw. And I was like, oh, where's his line? So thanks for that, Eric. Appreciate it.
Your thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube as we continue to break down the Lindsay Clancy case. The links are in the description.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for The New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's The Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.